This is one of the most well-behaved audiences I've ever seen. You're all so quiet.
So what do you guys think of the election results? Let's open up for some really good content. That was an outstanding.
How many people are sitting on the left? How many are on the right? Okay.
Let's turn these down.
Shock some people. That's too high.
Where's yours? You can't?
We're asking, can you turn it down?
Can you turn down a little bit? This is God speaking.
Maybe we should ask the question, can those of you in the back hear us okay? All right, we got some hands, thumbs up.
And can you see us? Because we're very, you know, tall people.
How about now? Okay. All right, is there anyone else standing out in the hallway? And people in the back, and they, you know, play coordinator here for us? Anybody out there? Okay. So convince them to close the doors and let's watch them come in and out. We've got a lot of content we want to cover, and we're going to go ahead and get started. I guess I should start the conversation by saying, sorry, we're on lunch prevention. So I think everyone's going to plan to eat after this session. Is that a good plan? Show of hands, who wants to eat after the session? Great, we'll get you to
good lunch. Idea. Participation. That always helps the speaker.
We'll get
speakers
you
in our case.
My name's Rob Sauerwald. I'm the Global Brand Manager for Client Server Virtualization, Systems X, IBM, obviously. First thing I want to do is thank you guys for coming. I know there's lots of sessions to go to, lots of content over the last couple of days and continuing on. We're happy that you took the time to come here. Hopefully you'll get some value out of what we're going to talk to you about. If you don't get value, hopefully Bob and I can entertain you a little bit. We aspire to entertainment and educate is kind of secondary. But this is Bob Zuber. Bob's the Worldwide Program Manager for server virtualization. So we get to work together on the x86 stuff specifically. I also tie out to our power-based products and the larger STG, if you're familiar with the IBM structure, kind of pieces. Obviously, today we're here to talk about the x86 pieces, cover some sizing. Why don't you just go ahead and get us started,
sure.
Bob, and move along here.
Great. So what we're going to try to do today is to talk about sizing, what type of servers for virtualization, and then lastly we'll talk about the systems management aspect of things. So this is the abstract we always have to show everyone all the time, but more importantly for the agenda, we'll go through some little things about sizing, some insights that we've gained from a lot of customer experiences, and then we'll talk about the portfolio. I've always asked like customers, what is the best platform for virtualization, and always my answer is it depends. So
we're in marketing.
Talk a little about that. What's that?
We're in marketing. The
answer
always depends.
It always depends. Lastly, we're going to talk about systems management and IBM Director along with infrastructure, Virtual Center, and our product that we have in IBM Director, which is Virtualization Manager. So
you can probably tell that Bob and I are not very shy.
No.
So if you have a question, I will ask you now not to hold it to the end. Raise your hand, yell out, I don't care. Just get our attention. We'll do the best we can to answer it. If it's going to take us a while to answer it, we may ask you to come up and talk to us afterwards. Or come on down to the booth because we're both back down there after the session. We're happy to spend a lot of time. Let me ask a couple of very quick questions. How many people here are VMware, and I'll use the word customer to mean end user. I've deployed it in my environment and I manage and maintain it. All right. How many people here are VMware, and hopefully IBM, partners, either vendor or otherwise? Okay. Good mix.
Good
mix. How many people here just don't wandered in and don't know why they're here? Oh, none.
No.
Oh, yeah, one. Okay. And your name, sir?
How did you get through security? Now, okay, so one of the things we're going to talk a little about from an IBM perspective is that, you know, from my perspective, I've been doing this probably about 15 years, but my father's been doing with IBM for 42 years. So I was one of these, you know, these brats that was born with wingtips. And back in the 70s, they developed this new OS for their piece of hardware. So we had this huge heritage in regards to, from a virtualization standpoint. It's done differently today, yes, but there's some rules that are still applicable today back in the 30s, well, 30 years ago, about 70, back in the 70s. So we're going to talk a little bit about that history a little bit. The main point here is that we have a broad suite of products that allows us to take advantages in regards to x86 and virtualization in that space, but also technologies that we have in our other brands, like our mainframes, and bring it down into the Intel space. So that's one of those things that we did, I forget how long ago, it was probably about 5-8 years ago, was our X architecture initiative. And now we'll talk a little bit more about that. Other things that we're doing too now is our Cool Blue initiative, along with also our virtualization management software. And lastly, we partner very closely with VMware, and we are one of their number one OEM vendors from a virtualization standpoint.
How many people have, and I'll figure out the way to word this, have energy management issues? They're constrained power and cooling.
Great.
How many people have solved a power and cooling challenge by using virtualization?
Okay.
How many people have caused a power and cooling challenge by using virtualization? Okay, a couple.
And how many people were around when we had water-cooled the machine? Okay.
Nice wingtip. Actually, probably one of the most important things on that slide that a lot of people don't realize is that we are indeed VMware's number one OEM vendor. So when VMware, or we'll just say ESX or Virtual Center, or Virtual Infrastructure, ships with a piece of hardware, more often than not, it's an IBM piece of hardware. And that really goes back to the heritage that Bob's talking about and the focus that we have on creating infrastructure solutions for our customers as opposed to selling people servers. So hopefully you'll see that theme as we go through this. Again, if at the end of this or as we go, we're not convincing you of what we're saying, raise your hand and ask us. We'll explain more.
Great. So number one thing that you should always consider in regards to from a virtualization perspective is sizing and make sure that you understand the type of workloads you're running and how they are utilized on those pieces of hardware. And if you just take a look at the different pieces of this sizing, ranges everything from just CPUs, memory, disk I.O., network bandwidth, but it's also other things like page extents and swap files and all that kind of fun stuff. But the most important thing is it's not always the CPU, right? There's other things that are inside the box, just as we built servers a couple years ago. Today, it's still just as important from a virtualization standpoint to understand the type of workload, how it affects the processor, how it affects the memory subsystem, how it affects the I.O. subsystem and front side bus and all those things. So there's a lot of things that you need to consider from a sizing perspective. Okay. Now, the next thing, too, is that we actually have been working with a lot of customers, and we do our own consolidation studies. Oh, we're probably up to about 10,000 servers now, and we're working with VMware in regards to their capacity planner and trying to pull this large data source of all these servers and workloads and be able to characterize that and produce things like our sizing guides that we have. The number one thing we found, though, was that workloads vary. One of our customers, Lego, saw that throughout their day, they always had this very diverse workloads throughout their infrastructure. But on average, they would always see that they had this average workload stream. But there's a lot of peaks and valleys within that average, utilization of their machines that constantly are going up and down. And that's, things like people coming in on Mondays and leaving on Fridays, other things where workloads are more peaking during key hours of the day, etc. So all those aspects from a sizing perspective need to be considered. Now, one of the things that we also need to think about is having this excess headroom or this ability to take those peaks and have resources be able to run those on the servers. But the big thing here is back even in the 70s, this is what they used to label headroom or have what we called up here on the hotspot avoidance is what Jim used to label it as. And all that really says is basically we need to have enough excess capacity on the server to ensure that as peaks occur, you have resources to accommodate that. Or you now need to move it to something else, like utilizing vMotion. Lego found that if you monitor your hardware and looked at the way things are utilized throughout the weeks, months, years, there are certain time periods when you can determine when it's most efficient to buy new hardware or to redeploy hardware or even get rid of hardware. And that also changes because of the way that their business changes. When is the most efficiency in regards to when do you execute? Waiting too long after the peaks occur is going to cause some problems for your customers from a performance point of view, but more importantly, you lost some opportunity because now you don't have the resources or the servers to accommodate that ability to flex with your business. And that may change the results of, or have opportunities will be changing your business results. The other aspect of that too, though, is if you execute too soon or too late, you also could see, markets declining, and now you have all this hardware you've purchased to ensure that you have that capacity. But now as your business declines, let's say after the first of the year, it's not needed anymore. The main point here is that you need to monitor your hardware, now actually watch your workloads, and be able to predictively determine how much hardware you need in regards to virtualization perspective.
So think about this model in a physical world. So when you ask these questions of installing more capacity or removing capacity, the idea of putting physical boxes in new applications or multiple copies of existing applications in, and then trying to remove them and repurpose them or remove them altogether, it's a bit of a handful. In fact, it doesn't happen. I'd love, if somebody is doing that physically, I'd love to talk to them. But this is what we're talking about, the benefits beyond partitioning when you use virtual infrastructure. A massive amount of flexibility.
So now one of the things that came up, we asked some of our IBM fellows, some three key things that were back in the 70s and even are still applicable today. And the big thing that was always consideration was what we call this hotspot avoidance. And it just says that as workloads peak simultaneously, I want to be able to have resources to ensure that I can expand and grow, like I mentioned before. So hotspot avoidance just says basically I want to make sure that I have enough hardware to accommodate the workloads so that as they peak simultaneously, I don't have these hotspots. Okay. The second piece was that leads into how much headroom. So it's very hard to determine how much headroom you need for these unpredictable workloads. As they flex up and down, how much do I leave over capacity on the machines? And if it's too high, I'm having a very underutilized machine. And then lastly is our peak load responsiveness. That's basically how fast can I take that workload and move it someplace else or change the environment to ensure that there's a lot of responsiveness to that new demand. How fast can you use the emotion, for instance, to be able to take that workload and move it to something else? These three rules are still applicable today, even though they were, you know, the same things we had back in the 70s. They're very, very applicable today, and we have a lot of guidance from our IBMers that have been doing this for quite a long time.
How many people know what an IBM fellow is? How many people went to a graduate school? Ever seen a professor with tenure? That's an IBM fellow. It's the highest ranking achievement that you can get to as a technical person at IBM. It essentially means you get to work on the technologies that you want to work on. Think of it more as research people. Jim's been doing this for a lot of years, and one of the most dynamic shifts that I've seen is he does have a mainframe heritage and our large power-based systems P. He used to spend 90% of his time on those platforms and looked at what we think of today as Systems X as, well, it's just a PC. Today, he probably spends about 70% of his time on Systems X and x86 virtualization. That's a dramatic shift that's happened in the last 2 years. Thank you. By the way, you're the reason for that. You are. As you look at the technology and adopt it, Jim is certainly looking at the market dynamic. So it's great to have old education, but Jim's also applying new thinking to new markets, so we're particularly proud of that. I just want to make sure you guys knew where that data and that opinion was coming from.
So there's two key applications today that we utilize within IBM and also outside. One is Capacity Planner from VMware, and the last one is CDAT. And being able to go out there and measure customers' workloads that range everything from all their servers to even clients and determine its utilization from average and peaks, all the data from data points ranging from hard drives to CPUs to memory, network HBAs, all those different aspects of, from a sizing perspective. So it's critical that you utilize the corresponding tools that we have in the marketplace. One of the key ones we like is Capacity Planner and then also CDAT from IBM. Okay. Now, one of the things that we always notice is that we have different types of workloads. We have very predictable workloads. They could be aggressive, or you could have unpredictable workloads or non-steady state applications. And the way that those machines in a virtualized state or a virtualized machine run, it could be very conducive to stack multiple workloads together. But as they run in a non-steady state, the concern there, once again, is how often do multiple peaks simultaneously occur or then utilize too much resources on the machines. So from a non-steady state the predictable workloads, it's great to be able to utilize fully your resource, but you need to understand how the workloads run and whether or not it's a steady state or a predictable workload or unpredictable workload versus is it a steady state and a predictable workload. And it could be aggressive, predictable workload, but more importantly, those unpredictable workloads are very hard to determine how to do their sizings. So what we're going to do is talk about things like Capacity Planner, how it goes out there and monitors all the machines, gathers data, even on an hourly basis, pulls that all together, And what we did with Capacity Planner and also CDET, we pulled all of these machines together, and we have a large now database of applications ranging from WebSphere to all the way up to, you know, terminal services on about 10,000 in the CDET studies and about another 20,000 on the Capacity Planner side. So we have a large population from a data source perspective. So we are actually going to look at all that information. We sort of have done that over the last couple of years.
We may actually have their data in there.
Exactly, yeah.
Without knowing it.
So one of the things from a methodology point of view is that we utilize in the first sizing guide about 3,200 servers. We consolidated all together, and we took about six different workloads, and they ranged from application server, web applications, Java, database, terminal services. We took all those workloads, and we modeled it against the data source, your servers, and figured out what did the typical database server look like on a two-way machine. What did it look like on a four-way machine? And we looked at and described each one of those different type of workloads. So on a 2P, legacy 2P machine, what was the average CPU use? What was the average utilization on that CPU? What was the peak utilization? What was the disk utilization? So on and so on. Okay? And out of that, we took all that information and put it into our model that we've been using for quite a long time to determine how those workloads can be effectively put on to machines. We have this source of old machines, and now we have this new target, these new machines, and how you take these old source workloads and move into the new targets. Okay. And out of that, we can have about six different insights. Number one, first thing is that software performance has variations. Okay. How it performs throughout the day in regards to, and also likewise, the relationships as it performs on the same machine as other software. So the predictability, that non-steady state versus steady state, is a concern of ours. And likewise, we need to look at the different types of software packages that, mm-hmm. that run on those machines. So there's a large variation. The other thing, too, was that as we looked at two ways, four ways, and eight ways, there was also some variation in regards to the software performance on each one of those different platforms. And I have some numbers on that. But the main point here is that software that was like a database software running on a 2P performs slightly differently than it does on a four-way and likewise on an eight-way. Okay? Thing here, too, was that that also guided us into how much headroom do you utilize on your machines to ensure that you can have that flexibility, that capacity to increase as the demand increases, right? So the headroom piece was calculated off of how predictable the workloads were and then also the software performance of each one of those workloads. Next piece was peak utilization versus average utilization. Which utilization do you use to size? If you're a very conservative company, you may utilize all the time is just peak. And we take all those peaks together, add them up together, and does it fit on this new machine? But that will say that you're very conservative. You have a lot more utilization that you could be using throughout the days when they're not peaking simultaneously. So looking at the workloads and being able to determine when it's peaking versus average is a concern here. And most important thing is that you need to make sure that you measure for both. Okay? Next piece was memory versus CPU constraints. There's other constraints within the system, but a lot of times we always have people looking at just the CPU. What's the best performing CPU for the server for virtualization? And they've forgotten all the other aspects, things that make a rounded and best designed machine. It's not just the CPU, it's also the memory subsystem, how fast is the front side bus, how fast are the disk drives, how fast are the HBAs. All those things need to be considered. The two pieces here, though, we saw just out of this one study was that CPU and memory were the first two constraints to be utilized. Now we're going to start seeing how efficient the code becomes. These two constraints will become less and less important, but now we're going to get into the how many HBAs do we have in the machines, how many NIC IOs we have, all those other aspects of the machines.
Yeah, the caveat there is all of the test systems did not have disk IO bottlenecks. So when Bob talks about CPU moving to memory, as kind of a secondary, disk would be the third, and you would expect network traffic to be the fourth. But we did not see appreciable disk I/O variances, so you don't see them in the results here. So if you feel you have a disk I/O problem, your mileage may vary.
Yes.
You were talking about the ratio between speed and average.
Right.
What the criteria makes you decide?
Great question.
We'll go right into the sizing guide about that, and I'll show you.
Great question.
That's actually considered in sizing guide.
Did everyone hear that question? It was, what guidance do you use to determine whether you're conservative, moderate, or aggressive, whether you would size based on peak or size based on average?
Right.
We're going to spend a good bit of time on that.
And the last piece from an insight perspective is also the scheduler. Think of the scheduler as, you know, the traffic cop in the system. As every clock cycle occurs, each VM needs a slice of resource, like the CPU, memory piece, or disk I.O. and whatnot. That scheduler, the concern there is, I always have people asking, is it better to have two two-ways versus a four-way, or is it better to have a two four-ways versus an eight-way? And once again, it depends on your workload. But the main thing here, though, is that when you look at the scheduler, it's always best to have larger number of CPUs. So that when you get at the head of the line, if you have a whole bunch of attendants and have a few machine, you know, a few openings, you can get scheduled much more efficiently, much more faster. Now, it used to be a linear equation when we started doing, you know, the initial VMware, because most of the VMs were always defined as a percentage of a CPU up to one. Now with having the variability being able to have two, and now with Trio having four, as you increase the number of VM sizes increase, this is one of the key pieces from a performance aspect. So when you get to the head of the line, if you have four boxes in your hand, you need four attendants to be able to service that workload. So it's very, you know, it's a big concern of ours is that as you define your VMs, to do it so in a manner that you understand that performance. We had one customer say, well, you know, I'm deploying file and print servers, so maybe I should define all the VMs as two CPUs, not realizing that in a two-way machine, every time he got to the head of the line on a single core machine, there's only two CPUs, he had to wait for the other workloads to release the two CPUs, not realizing that probably that file and print only needed one CPU to actually do the real work. So you need to understand the idea of sizing correctly and then make sure you have enough capacity. Yes, in the back.
And does the same insight apply in your
So from that perspective, we actually started doing some benchmarking from the virtual client aspect, and we're going to actually have a whole bunch of new workload types that's going to be accommodating that. So we're actually starting to do that sizing. So you're actually going to see two different sizing guides, one for services like this type of database and WebSphere and whatnot, and then you have another one for virtual clients. And they need power users all the way down to secretary users. Right now we're trying to get it in by second quarter. There's a lot of work to be done, but you know, we're doing the next update for 3.0 on this sizing guide, and then the next piece that we're going to start looking at is the virtual client piece.
Yeah, the nice thing about the client workloads are they're not quite as variable, because once someone has a desktop initiated, you know, the max to min can vary, but if you look at the average, a system's a system. From the client side, it's not nearly as variable as a lot of people banging on one application or two applications on a server environment. So it's a little bit easier. It's not quite as many data points. So we're hoping we can turn out pretty quickly.
So the three things
before you keep going, I have to ask a question. Pop back a slide. So he gave you a lot of insights, and the last one was scheduler contention. We asked the question earlier and said, how many people, you know, have deployed VMware? I'm not going to ask you whether it was server consolidation or whether it was just a better implementation or an infrastructure decision. How many people even know about the scheduler?
Good.
How many people considered the scheduler when they either sized their physical system or sized the virtual machines that they created? All right,
we've got some.
We
usually have
people
in
here.
Well, what are you talking about?
I like that.
That's good.
Good.
Educated people.
So those five or six people that raised their hand and said, I actually sized to it, turn to your left and say, hey, I can help you with that. Turn to your right and say, hey, I can help you with that.
So the three things that we're going to talk about from the sizing insights is going to be the headroom piece, the peak and average utilization, and the scheduler contention, okay? So we're not going to get into all the other pieces, but... So the number one thing was that out of the calculations for the CDAT studies, we found that on a two-way machine, the average utilization for the CPU ran about 7% on a two-way, all the way up to about 53%, okay? And then as you went down the list, you see that on a four-way machine, that was about 5%, and then last is about 35%, and then you have an 8P machine, you ran about 3%, and only down to 25%, okay? So you're looking at it and you're like, geez, why was the eight-way like running like 25% utilized? Right, that's barely using the machine at all. And there's not a lot of workloads that run on 8P machines that can utilize the full capacity of the machine. In fact, if you go out on the floor, you'll see we have a large 460 machine. It's got 128 gigabytes of memory. It's got 8 dual-core machines, the latest Tulsa processors, and barely using, you know, a tenth of the machine. So, and that's running a number of Exchange servers, a whole bunch of clients machines. It's running a whole bunch of virtual desktops. It's got a whole bunch of video streaming applications running on it. So it's got a lot of workload, but it's barely even taxing the machine at all. The point, though, is that the server headroom calculation is really the difference to take it to 90%. So what we did was we said what we really wanted to try to achieve in the perfect world is to take all these workloads and be able to put it on a new machine and be able to move the workload and just move the window so that on a two-way machine, we would like to see the average utilization about 44%, and then the peak around 90%. That left us with 37% headroom. Okay. So when we do the calculations for how much work we put on one single machine, we're going to base it all off of that first column, 44% for the average CPU utilization, and likewise 60% and 68% on an eight-way. So it just says we're going to move that window to try to achieve a perfect world, and we don't want to go to 100% of the full machine, but having all those peaks happening simultaneously, we'd like to try to achieve at least 90% utilization of the box. So that meant that on average, we would want to try to achieve 44% on a two-way, 60%, and then about 65% on an eight-way. Okay? So that just says this is how big the bucket is, and I'm going to try to utilize at least 40% of that bucket. Okay? And a lot of times when we talk to customers, they said, that's about actually where we calculated. So on our two ways, we didn't want to go to 50% or 60% or 70%. Because a lot of times when you look at sizing, we always have two sides of the calculations. It's like, you know, you have people who are paying for the project and say, we want to utilize as much as possible of those machines, those assets. So run those at 100% utilization. So the administrators load up a whole bunch of VMs, lots and lots of VMs, but as they peak simultaneously, now performance degrades. And those executives get the calls and users are complaining that virtualization doesn't work. Well, actually it is working, but you've oversized. So headroom just says how much room do I leave over to ensure that I get the performance I'm expecting without having to use the emotion kind of things. All right. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. Now the next thing is average or peak utilizations, right? So what we found on all of our studies, and we're going to continue increasing this, was that two ways and four ways, as you notice, the types of different workloads there were, the typical processor, for instance, on a database machine 2P was about a 1.8 gigahertz, right about 9%, and its peak utilization was about 60%. What we're going to do now is we're going to start looking at and slicing all this information up and saying, well, you know what, a database server on a two-way machine really maybe not be the right workload on that two-way machine. So we're going to try to eliminate a lot of these things so we can get even finer granularity in regards to the sizing parameters. Okay. The point, though, is that you need to make sure that you consider that. So all this information we've collected, we're going to be working with the VMware guys from Capacity Planner to make sure that we're also in line with them, and that's how we're going to start doing most of our modeling. Yes? Yeah, so the sizing guide, we actually have a whole bunch of things that talk about single core versus dual core versus four core piece. Yeah, so it's kind of, you'll see that, you know, from the source to the target aspect, as you increase the number of cores, for instance, the scheduler contention piece starts getting eliminated because as you have more cores, you have more processors to service. Based on less schedule possibility.
Yeah, based on the performance data. The two questions that we've gotten are on the same slide. I like that answer. So you guys are thinking right down the right path. I mean, the net of all this is if you size too large, you waste money. If you size too small, you break. Both of those are bad. Right. So we're here to give you some help to get it right and to get it right the first time. I would imagine, you know, of all those hands that said I deployed, there's got to be at least a few that said, yeah, we did our initial sizing, but we've tweaked it since then. We've learned a lot. I hear that a lot. I've learned a lot when we made our first deployments. So here's jump starts, at least a starting point.
Right. Because the other aspect, too, is that a lot of people will default and say, well, we'll just use vMotion when we get into trouble. We'll use vMotion to move the workload off. And remember what we talked about, that third rule, which was performance, how much degradation, and how fast can I move that peak responsiveness? How fast can I move something to something else? So it costs something to move work, right? So if it's running on that machine and you haven't sized it correctly, you're going to get into the point where you're actually moving more work than you're actually doing work. So you need to make sure that you size and use like vMotion, which is a great product, to ensure that as I get beyond those bounds that I didn't calculate for, I can move it off to something else. Okay. point here now is that we've actually broken down into two different tables. We have the top tables are our legacy 2P workloads. So those tables, we talked about all those servers that were typically running on 2P machines, took all those workloads, put into our modeling, and we sized it across a whole bunch of different servers, and the solid line represents the peak. How many workloads can I get on there simultaneously if they're both peaking, or
they're
N
all
number
peaking.
Peaking, all of them peaking.
All peaking.
The dashed line represents the average number of workloads that I can run on that machine if they're at average utilization. The letter corresponding in that column represents the constraint. So the first column typically, the first constraint typically was CPU. I ran out of CPUs because they were all peaking simultaneously. So obviously, peaking workloads utilize what? They're going to utilize CPU typically. The next aspect of it is the dashed line. As we go across from an average perspective, it's going to run out of something else, typically memory or virtual CPUs. The settings in 2.52 was set to 8 vCPUs per core of that processor from that perspective. So you're going to see a lot of things, and we've estimated some things, but you'll notice that on two single core versus a two core or dual core, you'll notice that you get a lot more VMs supported in peaking versus the single core. So as we increase the number of cores, the scheduler contention gets weighed out. You can actually have a lot more peak, what we call peak protection, so you can handle more peaking application or more peaking workloads. Okay? And in the bottom, you'll see the 4P workloads. Now, how do you determine it's between the two? One way to look for peaking versus averages. And it's our third rules, the actual third. What we've done is we have actually taken the first third is all the way up to the peaking resource that says, hey, take all the workloads you can run at peak utilization. That's the first thing. Multiply that by 2 and 3, and you get into the other quadrants. So the first one, for instance, on that 3850 4P machine, that was a 16-gig machine, it ran about 9 VMs before it ran out of CPU, all peaking simultaneously. Okay? Now remember, that was an old legacy workload running on a 2P machine. So I took a whole bunch of 2P machines that were running about 50% to 60% utilized and put it on a new box, brand new machine, that ran this, the latest Intel processor. Then the next piece was, in the green area was, hey, if I multiplied it by 2, and then multiplied it by 3 for the purple area. Now, what zone do you use? You use zone 1, 2, or 3? Depends upon things like how conservative you are. Think of that like your portfolio, your stock portfolios, or your retirement funds, and whatnot, your conservative, moderate, or aggressive behaviors. So aggressive applications like database, unpredictable workloads, no tolerance for performance segregation, you fall into the conservative category, right? Zone 2, moderate. Hey, it's a moderately aggressive application, collaboration, for instance. And then likewise, it was very predictable. It could be a very high-running application, but it was always predictable. It always ran this way, okay? And the last piece was they had some tolerance of performance segregation, meaning that, hey, it's okay that, you know, when I hit the enter button, it took a little, it took 2 seconds or 30 seconds longer to send an email versus, hey, I need to get that transaction done in milliseconds, okay? And the last is zone 3, which is the most aggressive. It's a lightly aggressive application, like a web application. There's hundreds of servers. So if that application goes down or it doesn't respond as quickly, there's others to take its load. And then likewise, it's a very predictable workload. So those are the three quadrants, okay?
So maybe we should ask. So we've given you conservative, moderate, and aggressive. How many people know which category they fall in?
Two and a half.
Two and a half. There we go. All right. So you'll like all of our slides. We're based on zone 2. How many people really do feel they're zone 1? They're extremely conservative. I size for everything peaking at the same time. How many people feel they fall in zone 2? I like the 2.5, though.
How about zone 3?
And zone
most
3?
Aggressive.
Really aggressive?
Because my CEO tell me to load as many VMs on that machine as possible. Okay, good.
All right, good.
So we picked the zone 2. And if you how you use this, the guide is really just it's mileage per, you know, per gallon kind of thing. And it just says, hey, if I wanted to get 18 VMs on a machine, I look down across the top at blue area, and I say, they just say 18. I go down the line and say, well, the checkbox, I could be in a zone. I could be running on a 3850 with 16 gigabytes, but you know what? It gets about 16 VMs before it ran out of memory. So, well, you know, I shouldn't really do that. I should move down to the next one. Well, that's 32 in this example, but you could have configured it as 24.
for instance, and that would probably run about 24 VMs. But the whole thing is, look at the guidance. This is a guidance sheet, not a, you know, it's, and your mileage may vary, but on most instances, people go, yeah, but what, can I get one or two more? Yeah, of course you can. But realize we left you enough headroom that you could even get four or even five or six more. The point is, this is a guidance, okay? So rough estimate, look at the sheet and go, that sounds about right. That's what I did. I feel confident now that looking at all this customer data backs me up, and I can go to my manager and say, hey, here's something we can run on that one box. Now, do your sizings also. You may have more aggressive applications than you determined, and now all of a sudden you're into zone one. You're much more conservative, okay?
Bob, do me a favor, pop back. I think we answered the question on how do I pick where I sit, right, and some of the criteria and what zone I'm in. But the other question that we had was, you know, how does dual core kind of change this? So one of the things that I wanted to point out is if you look at the single core line, we'll just pick the top one, the 35. Do you get the laser on that one? You can get to the top? The 346 with 8 gig of RAM versus the dual core 3650 with 8 gig of RAM. And what you find is if you asked me, dual core means I can run more VMs. How many people think that's true? How many people think if I put dual cores in, I can run more VMs? All right, well, look at our sizing chart. The largest number, which would be your lightly, you know, I'm very aggressive, my lightly aggressive applications, average utilization, very predictable. Look at that. They happen to cap it both at 8. That statement's only true when you say I can run more VMs running at peak. That's what dual core got me. It got me more peak protection.
Right.
Same number of VMs, but now if they peak, they'll run faster because the CPU is not the constraint if you're aggressive. It's the memory. Change the memory config. You're going to pay a lot for quad-core processors. If you don't put the right amount of memory in it, you won't peg those CPUs. You have the same problem you started with before you virtualized, totally underutilized. I just want to make sure we didn't miss that when we went through it.
Right.
Did everybody catch that the first time through, or is this a better way to interpret the data? That's what you get. So I'm a big believer in pay for what you use. If you're going to buy quad core, use it. Size it right. Put the right amount of memory in for the type of applications that you have.
And that's going to really determine how machines are going to be designed. Okay. One of the concerns we're going to have is that as we get into quad core, for instance, those one-use servers are great little one-use servers, but they don't have enough DIMM slots to make sure that you have enough memory to ensure that you have enough, you have all the CPUs can be occupying a full utilization and have enough memory to ensure that you have the number of VMs that you're looking for. That's why bigger machines could actually have more bigger DIMMs, a lot more memory. Yes?
Hardware.
Oh, there is. So right now we even haven't hit that yet. So we haven't saturated the bus yet enough. So that's the other aspect of it. So as you start seeing more VMs being moved around and actually utilizing bigger VMs, remember, these are all legacy VMs, very, very small machines. They're running at 5% utilization. If we're talking on VMs that are running at 90%, putting it on a new box, that's when you're going to start seeing front-side bus saturations. And that's going to be that's one of the other pieces of it. But front-side buses are now also increasing in speed, and also having dedicated front-side buses to the each one of the cores. That's going to change also.
So I don't think we can emphasize enough the whole point of putting the sizing guide together is because we saw this huge chasm between people that had experience deploying virtualized solutions and people that were looking at it. I would imagine, you know, a majority of the people here that said I've deployed went through some kind of proof of concept. And as I said, you know, we learned a lot is a lot of times what I heard. Your mileage will vary. We get to say that tongue-in-cheek because we're in marketing. But the idea here was get you to the right area. Take a look at it. Understand the things that you need to know in order to adjust what that general sizing is. Understand the difference between peak and average. Understand the difference between CPU is my problem and memory is my problem. Understand the difference between, yeah, I'm very conservative or I'm really aggressive, and translate that to a much better start. In the end, maybe we're helping you learn before you have to learn on your own, and that's what we're after here.
Yeah.
Yes?
Maybe you have to
do same kind of analysis on this item. Actually, it's in there. But once again, we didn't hit that contention.
Didn't constrain us. Ran out of memory long before.
Right. The sizing guide actually has disk I.O., but those old legacy machines, the disk I.O. was so minimal that it wasn't even a constraint that we saw.
So I should ask you, Bob, did we bring any copies to the sizing guide?
No, I did not. I forgot.
All right. Yeah. I know you're all going to go to lunch after the session, right? We did check that earlier. If you come down to the IBM booth, we do have hard copies of the sizing guide, and we do have it posted to the web. So if you want to peruse, we've got all the backup data on disk and memory and how we average those workloads. So we've got it at the booth. You can come down and get it.
Question. It's not on that part of the website, but it's on system sales right now, and if you send me a note, then I'll make sure we get it over there also. Okay.
I actually work on a 168. I know Barry Muir, I'll talk to him, I know Mario Moreno, I'm a big master. I know RMF, I know SMF. And we have GAD and load of the customer space, and we can come up with an answer in a pretty short period of time. How long does it take you to do something?
To do the sizing? You're right. So every other day, every other week, every other month, he was constantly, when are you going to get that done? It took us, Joe and I, the performance guy, and then myself, doing all statistical, it took us probably about 8 months. Now we know how to do it, so now it's a matter of sitting down and taking all the models that we have, and then likewise, we're going to take all that information and put it into the lab and say, now, Joe, let's start looking at how we can tweak the machines and change the designs and run actual real-world workloads to try to mimic exactly the modeling that we have.
So I'll go back to the earlier question on clients. I think we can turn the client piece faster because we know how to do it now. The concern that I always had and Bob's probably going to laugh when I say this, is anybody can throw data at you. To me, it's important that you look at the data, do some level of analysis, and tell you, how might this impact you? Because there's no way in one sizing guide that, by the way, is only 2 pages long,
right?
I can say for you in particular, I understand everything that's going on. It's a start. I always say that it's good in the absence of individual information. So by all means, if you want to get deeper into this and you want to talk about your environment, if you don't want to eat, you can talk to us afterwards or you can come down to the booth later.
Well, you don't have to now.
Well, the point is we've done it.
I don't want to make you guys experts. It's just use the guide. And then if you want to have to come in and do the sizing to make sure it matches up, that's one thing. Don't go out there and do,
So maybe if I looked at it differently, our experience with early adopters was it took 3 to 6 months to go through the process, get the proof of concept, get people to buy in that'll work. And I know everyone probably has a different schedule, but I'm kind of averaging. So I'm always willing to hear, no, it took us 2 years. No, we did it in a quarter, right? But in the end, hopefully what we've done is eliminate the first half or three quarters of that process by giving you a starting point. You tweak it a little, and then you can go right into production with it.
Right. In fact, the modeling tool that we use to do all this, we're applying for a patent for it. So it's kind of like, we know how to do this now. We're getting better at it. I know what to look for. Joe knows how to tweak the machine. So we're getting better at it. I don't want everyone to be experts in it. Let's just give you guys the information, and then we'll collaborate with VMware and make sure that we are always constantly getting the most information out there as quickest as possible, that information.
So before we pop on the scheduler, because I kind of asked this question, are we at the right technical level for you guys? Are we going deep enough, or are you dying for more data, or a little less data, a little more impact?
We're going to run over.
Yeah, so that's why I'm worried. Just right?
That's right.
So just keep plugging then. All right, question quick.
Yeah, do you have any comparisons on memory generation based on single or dual
domain? So that part of it was the next piece that we're going to work with VMware guys, because that's my biggest concern now, is that the memory performance, it was just, how much memory do I have? What was my memory I/O piece? How big was the page table? What the extents were? Next thing I wanted to do was, wait a minute, what are we running with, DDR2, DDR3? Probably buffer DIMMs, all those pieces of it are going to now speed up the memory subsystem piece.
A great example.
And that's the next piece that we are measuring.
A great example. We maximize the memory configuration in each one of these. So a great example is in a 3950. We spread them across the memory cards so that you got the same idea in a database. Get me more spindles, right? So I can get better response time. So in this particular case, we've optimized that memory configuration for our platforms. All right, wait, one more quick question. We want to keep moving. No.
We were not. No. I don't want to do that.
No. Bad idea.
We'll look at that next, but the problem there was that when we talked to the performance guys, it's going to start saturating the machine, and we were like, let's just too many variables. Let's try to cut them down and make them into real world examples and try to get, you know, get the sizing tool out.
That's a perfect example in my mind of the last 10 yards, right? You kind of start here in the last 10 yards, and that works for my application set. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it has, you know, a negligible effect on the business if it happens and you do oversaturate. Sometimes it has a horrific effect on the business. So to me, that's the last piece of it.
The next piece was the scheduler contention piece. And this is well documented in a lot of VMware documents. The big thing here is that, you know, when is it best to use a two-way versus a four-way, right? So now if you take an example of it, you just look at, hey, I have a two-way single core machine. And all along here I have these workloads. And the fully colored machines are 100% utilized for that CPU, and then within the dotted lines is, hey, that's a two-way vCPU, or even better yet, here's with four-way. And as we get to the head of the line for each clock cycle, you can see that each VM will utilize the corresponding number of cores, but it takes time to do so. And obviously the last one can't take it because it doesn't have four CPUs to do it.
Notice it's the same workload. One, two, two,
yeah,
one.
Yeah, exactly
the
same workload.
Now,
across the top, you know, when is it best to have a dual core two-way versus a single core four-way?
Guess what?
It's the same, right? But it does a job at a much faster rate than the other previous example. Now, when is it best to do it on a dual core four-way? Well, now you have eight CPUs. Obviously, a lot less clock cycle.
Two clock cycles.
Right. Now, I've tried to make it as simple as possible so they can get it down to the masses. This is not an example of the scheduler piece, so don't go and think, oh, well, Bob said this is how the scheduler works. This is an
example.
That's my job. This, right?
I get to do that, Bob said.
Right, exactly. So understand that the number of cores is corresponding to also how variable the workload definition is, so that that VM, if it's a single core VM or a single vCPU VM, it was a linear equation. You get to the head of the line, if there was four processors there or there was two, one out of two chances, one out of four chances, it's the same, it's linear. Now when you start adding in, it's an exponential curve, because now as it got to the head of the line, when you defined it as a four-way, a four vCPU machine, it wants how many CPUs? Four, because it doesn't know that one workload is really only using 25% of that thing. You define it as four, so it's going to anticipate four. Go and get them all. That's how the scheduler works. Okay.
Yeah, so there's two ways you could think about this, right? I need to have more cores if I have larger virtual CPU machines.
Right.
I think you guys all got that out of that, right?
Right.
The kind of second layer behind that is what really causes you challenges and introduces latency when you don't use larger numbers of cores is the variability in the size of those
yep.
virtual machines.
Thanks.
So when you have ones, twos, fours, more twos, some ones, that's when you get to start queuing.
Question?
I was just
wondering how you count the overhead. So that's actually calculated in the headroom piece. So we're going to actually sit down with the VMware guys, and we're changing the model now with the 3.0 piece, so the scheduler got more efficient. So that's going to be taken in an FX aspect of the next guide. So
would you be surprised if I said I want you to cover the portfolio really quickly? How many people know the IBM hardware portfolio? How many people know it better than I do? Better than Bob does? Come on, there's a couple of you out there, right? There you go, yelling. All right. Resellers, users, I love that. So we'll kind of go through this pretty quickly. All right? And I think
I did already.
Oh, well, hold on. That's all you need to know.
Did you guys see that?
I think the most important parts are these. Bob's already ahead of me.
Oh, hold on.
Yeah,
this
go back to the comparisons. Go back to the comparisons. I want you guys to see this because I want you to look
just
at
these two slides.
In my mind, one of the sins of IBM in the x86 space, we did a really good job of coming out and talking to you guys about the benefits of virtualization when you do server consolidation. And I would imagine most of you started your virtualization education by trying to do server console projects. What's true is that virtualization actually makes all x86 better, not just server consolidation projects. Now, our product line is pretty much split up into three scenarios where you have blades, you have what we think of as our high-volume racks and towers and our scalable systems. And we tried to oversimplify this. If you're thinking about infrastructure, you think about blades. If you're thinking about just servers, don't think about blades. It doesn't make sense. If you're thinking about networking, your power packaging and cooling, you're thinking about storage, fabric integration, that's what blades is about. Virtualization makes that better. It's the mobility. It's the infrastructure statement. It's the manageability. It makes it better. Does that mean you don't get that? on the high volume stuff? No, but it really has a good affiliation with that. Server consolidation on the other end, scalable systems is kind of where we started with this. It makes server consolidation better. Now apps don't have to be so nice to each other. I can get my utilizations up. But in the middle, I think we haven't spent enough time talking about, well, why would you virtualize a two-way? Well, a two-way with multi-cores and a lot more DIMMs. And 7% utilization goes to 2% utilization. And my applications aren't being written for multi-thread. Everything's single-thread. You're going to buy a system and you're not even going to use it. Well, unless everyone goes out and rewrites all those applications, the only way to drive what I paid for is to virtualize. So application serving gets a lot better. We can finally break that, you know, everything I do, break one app, one system, break that rule. So virtualization actually makes all of these machines do their jobs better. And we've got a whole bunch of comparisons that show you what the cost equations go and change. We're not going to run through every single one of them because I don't think we have enough time, but they're out there. Just give you one example, and they're all like this, all the same way. This is, you know, before you virtualize a blade, after you virtualize a blade. In this particular scenario, we got 14 2P blades with one app on them. By the way, we picked Zone 2. So I was happy to hear that everybody said that they're in there. Straight acquisition cost. We tried to make this simple. We didn't try to put any, you know, smoke and mirrors in it. Your mileage may vary there. And when you get right down to it, for the hardware and the software pieces, you know, the cost per application is about $8,000. Well, if you virtualize that same scenario, same hardware, 14 blades, both two procs, and you use a Zone 2 where you're recommending 4 VMs per system, you get yourself, after you do it, and I'm not going to do the power calcs and all those kind of things, it's $3,500 an app. It just made infrastructure consolidation or simplification or integration a whole hell of a lot better.
Right.
Same thing when you look at two proc, what we think of as high volume, same thing when you look at four-way. And the only real difference when you look at these scenarios, and just get me down to the end where I have 2Ps and 4Ps, because people make this horribly difficult. I hate horribly difficult. I mean, terrible. So those are nice 18 servers versus 4P. Give me my 2-4. Here it comes.
That one?
No, that's a lot of twos versus a four. There you go. Summary slide. When do you pick a 2P over a 4P? Depends on how many machines you got and how big they are. It's not any more complicated than that. If you're only going to do, and you'll see in the previous slides, if you're only going to do 18 VMs, don't buy four-way. You know, if you're going to do 36
or 72,
then it's cheaper on a four-way than on a two-way. If you're doing departmental or application virtualization, two ways are great for that. That's what they're designed to do. That's application serving. If you're thinking at the data center level, you're thinking server infrastructure, all my servers, and you're after the smallest number of things, actually eight ways are the best in that scenario, but four ways and scalable eight ways. Don't overcomplicate it. The only other scenario that I'd put out there that as you think about these things is if you're going to standardize on a virtual building block, 8-way may be the most efficient for where you are today because of the large number. And ask yourself, when I put the next VM on, the next application, you know, when I go from 100 to 101, where I've now gone beyond the capacity of what I've installed, do I want to buy a whole other 8-way for that?
Right.
Or am I willing to do some mixing? So the granularity level of your building block is the other kind of scenario you want to think about. And by the way, this, that same conversation, doesn't matter whether it's racks or blades. You do two ways in blades, you do four ways in blades, it's a server conversation. Blades are a much bigger conversation than a server conversation.
More the infrastructure, consolidating your servers, your networking, your disk IOs.
Was that conversation helpful? Do you guys get asked that question a lot? Do you have to answer that question a lot?
We always have, you know, customers come in, well, you know, like your competitor said that two ways, everything's to be on a two-way. And it's like, well, that's the same people that would say that a hammer can put a screw in a wall, too, but, you know. Yeah, you could do it. It's just you're going to have more of them. So look at your workloads and make sure that you have, you know, we're giving you a lot of information. It's not a simple answer. So, you know, it doesn't always fit on a two-way. Okay.
The net of this in my mind is that if you understand the hardware and you get the hardware sized right, virtualization is going to drive tremendous benefits. And it sounds like most of you have already seen some of those benefits. I would hope that you've also seen some of the complexities that it drives and the challenges that it drives, and that's really in the management aspect. So if you want to just pop through these, how many people are familiar with IBM Director?
Good.
Oh, how many people are running IBM Director? Well, okay. Excellent. How many people are running Director version 5-something? How many 4-something? Ah, I had to talk to you. Okay, I got to talk to you. But the idea here is this is what we've found, right, is that systems management really is the thing that makes it fly. It makes it hum. It gives me all those other TCO benefits beyond the hardware kind of scenario. Right, so pop me back to just give me the whole list and we don't have to go through
that one
thing. Yeah, just so here. Right. So, you know, what we have found is that I don't want to give you a whole new tool set. Manage your virtual environment. I've also found that your virtual environment isn't your entire environment. So I've got to manage physical and logical together. I've got to show the relationships. I want to go to the same place to manage my physical machine that has my logical machines on it, as well as the physical machine that has no logical machines on it.
Right.
So that's what IBM Director and Virtualization Manager, which is the extension to IBM Director, does. Puts all of those things in the same place. It's not a replacement for Virtual Center. If you still want to go in and you want to manage just the VMware virtual environment and the machines that are tagged to that virtual environment, you can do that. A lot more function in Director from the hardware perspective, whether you want to do some alerting or some predictive failure alerts or tie those hardware-based alerts into virtual actions. I like to call it automation, but it's really a stimuli response. If this happens, take that action. You can do that with Director the way it is today. And you can go back from Director to Virtual Center. Like, for instance, if this happens, move a VM. Director does not have vMotion embedded in it. You have Virtual Center and vMotion. It sends the instruction. We go through the API, and it moves. We're going to be doing the same thing with DRS and the HA stuff that are now in 3. But the idea of being able to manage an environment, manage the pool of systems, give availability is what this is about. I call it care and feeding hardware. In my definition, hardware is server, storage, networking. It's the physical box, the operating system, and the hypervisor. So if you ever hear me say platform or hardware management, that's what I'm talking about. Man, you went through the screens and everything.
That's great.
I want to give you guys a chance to ask some questions. I would say that if you have management issues or you'd like to see better ways to do things, come down. I have Virtualization Manager running live in the booth. We have virtual clients running live in the booth. We've got the 4-way, 8-way comparisons running live in the booth. We got a pretty big booth.
Yes, we do.
It's pretty big.
We have a big, large 8-way.
So I don't want to...
Actually, the largest 8-way because we have 128
gigabytes of memory.
Yeah.
So I want to let you guys go to lunch, but before you leave, any questions? Anything in particular? Can I ask one question? Valuable stuff? Good information? Stuff I already knew. Good information?
All right, good.
Would you recommend this session to your friends?
All right,
that's good.
You filled out your forms, and the young lady on the outside will be collecting
Thank
them.
You so much for your time, everyone. Guys. Appreciate it.
Okay.
I'm with IBM Business Partners.
Oh, great. In the local area.
How you doing? Hi. Oh, he's got a slide. I was in here.